Welcome to Casey Art Pie, where the art scene is positively scrumptious. I'm your host, Rochelle Gardner-Rowe. Debuting during Women's History Month, that is March of 2017, Casey Art Pie will focus on a project called Femin Is, an online and offline project and exhibition that will explore a range of issues on feminism and the arts from our unique Kansas City perspective. On today's episode, I'll be speaking with poet Gloria Vando Hickok about Helicon 9, the Journal of Women's Arts and Letters, which she founded in 1977 in Kansas City, Missouri, to provide a quality literary publication by and about women. The magazine provided a forum for women in the arts at a time when women were being excluded from major anthologies, history books, museums, and academic curricula. It published the work of well over 500 artists, and in 1992, Helicon 9 changed its name to the Midwest Center for the Literary Arts, in order to expand its mission to include 1, the publication of fine books of literature through Helicon 9 editions, and 2, the founding of the Writer's Place, a regional literary community center, library, and gallery that continues today offering public and educational programs for all ages. As a poet, Gloria has edited and published numerous anthologies of poetry and received awards for her own works, including Prometheus, Geography of the Impossible, which is a personal encounter with the history of colonialism and her family roots in Puerto Rico, Shadows and Supposes, named the best poetry book of 2003 by the Latino Hall of Fame, and Woven Voices, a cross-generational work with her mother and daughter. Though she returns to Kansas City regularly, she now lives in California, where she joined me by phone for the interview. I'll be back with Gloria to talk about Helicon 9, The Writer's Place, and of course poetry, after the break. The KC Art Pie podcast is supported by an inspiration grant from the Arts KC Regional Arts Council, whose mission is to unleash the power of the arts. Whether you're an artist, company, or community member, check out artskc.org to see how you can join them in their vision to build a city of great dreams and vigorous life where everyone participates in and benefits from the arts. Now, back to the episode. Gloria, welcome to KC Art Pie, and thank you for participating in Femin Is.
Well, I'm excited, and thank you for inviting me. I'm honored.
So, Gloria, my first question about Helicon 9 is, what exactly did that name mean?
The name? Oh, gosh. Well, Helicon was a glen in Mount Olympus, and the Helicon 9 were the 9 muses of Helicon. And they were the daughters of Zeus and Mnemosyne, which means memory in Greek. And they had inspiratory powers, and they presided over literature, science, and the arts. Now, all this came from the Theogony, which was written by Hesiod in the 8th century. But before they were born, there was no music. There was no art. There was nothing in the world. It was, you know, a bleak place. And once they were born, they had inspiratory power, so they would inspire men by pouring honey into their mouths. And as Hesiod wrote, from their mouths would sweet words flow. Can you believe it? So there we were in the kitchen feeding our men. Not Helicon 9, however, because in Helicon 9 we inspired ourselves and each other. Two funny anecdotes about the title, which you might enjoy. We once received a submission from a writer, and he was under the impression that Helicon 9 was a radical magazine named for, you know, a group of political activists such as the Chicago 7. And I actually thought of making a T-shirt with dancing muses shackled to one another, and blazoned across the front, "Free the Helicon 9." I never did it, but I still think about it.
Oh, there's still time.
Yeah. The other thing is we received a submission one time from some guy who wrote, "Dear Mr. Nine."
Oh.
The name has always been kind of mysterious, but I like that. It was better than Venus Envy, which we also thought about.
Oh.
A lot of fun taking that, yes.
It sounds like you did. And on the Helicon 9 website, the main homepage features one of those quotes from Hesiod. It says, "We start then with the muses who delight with song, telling of things that are, that will be, and that were, with voices joined in harmony. So I thought that was quite beautiful. So what was the catalyst for this? How did Helica 9 get started?
I guess I was just sort of dismayed by the fact that women were not achieving the recognition they deserved. When I went to NYU, I studied art, and well, my major was actually philosophy and literature, but I studied art, and in my textbook, there was not a mention of one woman artist. Mary Cassatt was a footnote, and they weren't even sure she was a real impressionist. And the book was written by a woman, Helen Gardner. And what is more dismaying than that is the fact that I didn't even respond to that until later. I didn't think about that. I guess it was the feminist movement, or maybe my mother, or I don't know. Anyway, I finally got a consciousness about our place in the world and decided that it was time to do something. I was also submitting a lot of poems to a lot of magazines, and the editorial boards of every magazine, they were all white males, and the Paris Review notwithstanding. So that was one of the catalysts for how it was started. Also, I lived in Europe and different places, and I kept meeting these phenomenal artists. And I kept thinking, gee, it'd be wonderful if they could meet each other. Wouldn't it be great to have a big party? And Helicon 9 became a forum for them, and they met each other, and they read about each other. And it was really a wonderful experience. And in Kansas City was incredibly nurturing to artists and the arts. It just was. It was wonderful. I don't believe I could have started the magazine anywhere else. I mean, there were just women everywhere. It was amazing because Marty Nichols was the president of the Kansas City Philharmonic. Pat McElrath was director of the Missouri Rep. Tatiana Dukodowska, I think that's how you pronounce the name, was the founder and director of the Kansas City Ballet. Philomene Bennett was one of the founders of the Kansas City Artists Coalition.
Yes, I recently had the opportunity to speak with Philomene Bennett.
Oh, how nice. Oh, she was wonderful. She was our art editor, and her painting appeared on the front page of the first edition, on the cover. And she said, I can't do it. I'm the editor. I said, I'll fire you. We must have your painting. So there were these very strong women in the arts in Kansas City. And what was interesting was that both men and women supported the arts. So I felt very safe there. And I had lots of good friends who were in the arts.
And so digging into a little bit about what was in Helicon 9, maybe tell our listeners a few of the topics and art forms that the magazine covered. I'm sure there were many.
Let me see. We had poetry, essays. We had plays. We had things about composers. We had a pull-out recording, which is very interesting because Judith Norell, a harpsichordist, submitted an article about a 17th century composer named Elizabeth Jacquet de la Guerre. And I'd never heard of her. I asked her, I said, can you send me a tape or something of her music? And she did, and I was overwhelmed. And at that point decided that we had to have a pull-out record in every issue. And that was really a different thing. Also, we had everything was in color. All the art was in color. So that was important, too.
And very rich color, Philomene mentioned in our discussion of Helicon 9. All the time she spent at the printers making sure that it was just right.
All night sometimes. And we had architects, sculptors, filmmakers, painters. And there were two spies. One was the poet Maria Manas, who was a spy during World War II, and the sculptor Patience Lovell Wright, who was a spy during the American Revolution. And so it was fun. It was really terrific. I loved it.
Did you have any particular favorite editions or favorite authors or contributors? I know that maybe that's a little bit of an unfair question with so many volumes.
Well, there were so many, and they were so good. But the peace issue, of course, is one of my favorites because I'm a peacenik. And the Marianne Moore issue I loved. And I loved the writing in it, the people who wrote about her. And one of them was Elizabeth Cray. She was the inspiration for The Writer's Place. She and Stanley Kunitz at that time were starting Poets House in New York. And Helicon 9 had gotten a grant from the Andrew Mellon Foundation. We were one of six. Beyond Baroque was another. And they were a literary center in Venice, California. And I thought, well, you know, they have one in Venice, California. They have one in New York City, which they're starting. We can start one in Kansas City.
Yeah, right in the middle.
That's right. Exactly. One of my favorite poems was by Regina de Cormier-Chakurjan. She sent us an unsolicited poem called Instruction of Clotilde. It's a poem about the medieval days. And I was reading it, and after I read it, I put it down. I said, who is this person? And I called her on the telephone. And I said, I don't know who you are, but you're magnificent. And I've got to publish this poem. And we started talking, and we became very good friends on the phone. But I never met her. We never met, but we talked on the phone regularly. And then I published her book. Later, she submitted her book to the Marianne Moore Poetry Contest, and Richard Howard picked it as the winner.
Now, that contest was one of the competitions that Helicon 9 developed.
When we started books, when we started publishing books, we had a Willa Cather fiction contest and a Marianne Moore poetry contest. Both were Midwestern authors. Marianne Moore was from St. Louis, and Willa Cather was from Nebraska. So we named the masters two women and got wonderful submissions. I mean, my God, it was just unbelievable.
I think this is something about the legacy of Helicon 9, even though, you know, it was founded in 1977, you just kept going. That just takes such an enormous amount of dedication, and they're beautiful publications.
Aren't they lovely? Yeah, I was looking through them last night. I was so pleased. Tim did a beautiful job.
So maybe tell me a little bit about how Helicon 9 changed over time and developed into including the Writer's Place.
Well, we did the magazine for about 10 years, and we were all volunteers. I mean, nobody ever received a penny except the business manager after we started doing books. But we just all came together and did this for 10 years. But after 10 years, people started getting tired, or they started finding jobs that paid. And so we were losing some of our staff, and I thought, well, you know, maybe 10 years is enough, and we did the Helicon 9 Reader. And then I still had the need to make some of these voices public, because I love literature, and I love people, and I thought it would be nice to continue as a press. So we started the two contests, and we got, oh my God, 1,000 submissions. It was amazing. It was $1,000 prize plus a reading with the judge at the Writer's Place, because by then the Writer's Place had been started. Writer's Place started in 1992, and that's how we started the books. I've never been sorry. We did several anthologies also, and then we did the little foyers because I thought it was interesting to introduce people to authors, and also they were very inexpensive and easy. I only did 250 of each one.
Maybe explain to our listeners who may not know what a foyer is.
It means leaf in French, but in years past, newspapers would have what they called the feuilleton, which was the bottom half of one of the editorial pages where they would do poetry. Actually, they did publish poetry in newspapers. And so that kind of, that's how we got the name. Anyway, that's what we did. The other thing that I think is important is that we never raised the price on our books. $9.95 for the poetry book. And the fiction was $12.95. Anthologies were $14.95 because, of course, they were more expensive to make. But the little foyers, I hand-stitched.
Wow.
And I loved it, making books. I mean, they were lovely. They were little art books. And they were individual poems or an individual story. lovely. And I'm sorry I stopped that, but I got tired. I couldn't stitch anymore.
The last
edition, I think we stapled together, or had stapled.
So you were hand sewing these foyers together?
Oh, yes, with little knots in the center.
Oh, wow.
It was fun.
So I didn't know if you had any stories to share about the early days of the Writer's Place, the people involved, or what were some of the first activities that took place there?
Well, one of the other reasons why the Writer's Place came to be, and this is important, Phil Miller was a poet who was teaching at Kansas City, Kansas Community College. And he was giving readings. He would host readings in different places like galleries or the Kansas City Artists Coalition or restaurants even, or meeting rooms in libraries and so forth. And after the readings were finished, we had to leave. And I thought, you know, this is really not fair. Artists have their galleries and composers have their concert halls, and everyone's got a place except poets and writers, and we need something. And I spoke to Bill about it, and he said, what a great idea. And Bill was my husband. He passed away 2 years ago. And he had a foundation, which was nice, and so he called a real estate agent, and he said, go find us a building. And she called and said, I found it. I found the castle. The Writer's Castle. And we said, great. We went to look at it, fell in love with it. The foundation bought it, so the foundation owns the building.
And for anyone who hasn't been to the Writer's Place, it really does have a little bit, especially from the outside, it feels like a castle.
Yes, well, it's got a crenellated tower.
Mm-hmm.
It's got a little keep in the center. It's really lovely. It was owned, the people who owned it went down with the Titanic.
That's the
story. And then eventually it became a house of ill repute. And in fact, when we moved in, there were little numbers on doors upstairs. When we bought it, it was a Church of the Beloved Hand. And it had pews nailed to the floor. And it had an organ loft. And it was really messy and terrible.
How fitting is it that the Writer's Place, the actual building, had so many stories of its own as you came into it? That just seems perfect.
And my son-in-law, Len Fusco, came down to Kansas City and redesigned downstairs and put in a beautiful staircase. And we had all these poets. I still remember Bob Stewart with a broom in his hand sweeping the floors. Phil Miller painting. Sharon Eicher with one of those great big sledgehammers knocking down walls.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it was so exciting and so wonderful. And everyone had a sense of ownership. It was our place. And the other thing, of course, is that we started the gallery because I've loved the arts. I love visual arts. I've studied art, painting. And so we had a gallery, and I was a curator until 1995, so from 92 to 95.
And sorry, was this in the Writer's Place or was this someplace else? The gallery.
No, this is at the Writer's Place.
Okay.
The downstairs was an art gallery, and I wanted text art. So we started with Robert Motherwell's A la Pintura, which was a series of lithographs with illuminating the poetry of Rafael Alberti. And that was the first our opening. And then we had Seven Deadly Sins by William Burroughs. And he came.
Oh, wow.
And that was exciting. The place was packed. You could hardly walk in the door. And he sat there and signed books at the opening. And people, their line went on and on. And one woman came up to him and said, would you please sign your name on my arm? I want to have it tattooed. And he said, that's ridiculous. You don't want to do that. Said, yes, I do. And he said, oh, all right. And he took a magic marker and he wrote his name from her shoulder down to her fingers.
Oh, wow. I guess he decided, well, if you mean it, you're going to have to commit.
Exactly.
That would be a mighty tattoo.
He was so funny.
Well, clearly there's so many stories that have come out of the Writer's Place and will continue to come out of there.
Yeah.
Just sort of take a broad look historically. Did you have a sense that the national movement of feminism in the 1970s affected what was going on in Kansas City, or did it feel a bit more isolated?
Yeah, well, I was a member of NOW. You know, I was out there walking and, you know, with the picketing and all kinds of stuff. So, yes, and coming from Texas, it was very exciting. We had a lot of the feminist movement had definitely come to Kansas City. In fact, one of our exhibits, our second edition of Helicon 9, the magazine, we had an art exhibit of art from Helicon 9 at the first women's bank in New York City. And we drove up there with books, had all the paintings from the magazine hanging in the bank.
Oh, wow.
So that was very nice. But yes, Kansas City was definitely aware of what was going on in the world.
Did that era, the radical feminism of the era, did it affect your own work, your personal work at all, or?
Well, not really, because I always had a sense of my own feminism. And writing is a very private thing. I was not a political writer in that sense, although I did write a lot of poetry that is considered political. But I guess it did. It does make you aware of what's going on in the world and around you and in you. So in that regard, I have to say yes.
Well, and I was wondering if you would be willing to share a poem with us.
I was going to read one poem, but I think I'm going to read another one. And this was written for Daisy Rao. And Daisy was from North Korea. And it's called Wind Chill Factor. You point to a photo of your family taken after they fled from North Korea, your infant mother in her father's arms, despots pursuing them the way Uncle Sam pursued my grandparents after confiscating their power, their land, its yield of sugar and coffee, iron and ore, giving them 3 weeks, always 3 weeks, to relocate. Before the exodus, your mother awoke each morning in a tepid bath, her sleeping body phased into a basin of wrist-warm water to lessen the shock of life, the anticipated march across the wide divide between privilege and anonymity, snipers, landmines at every turn. As a child, I awoke to tepid clothes, my grandmother warming each tiny garment with her body, my socks running a low temperature under each arm, my panties wedged in her cleavage, my shirt sleeves embracing her neck, her whole body a conduit of early morning comfort as she dressed me under the covers, easing me into the glare of indifference, then rage against an alien shade or sound. She taught me to braid my hair, gathering the three strands like warring factions between her fingers, plaiting them over and under and over and under until a perfect braid emerged, my world in safe and tidy harmony. Grown up, I wear my hair in a bun, the skill of my grandmother's hands and mine, weaving then coiling the long, thin braid into a perfect circle at the nape of my neck, insulating me still against the chill.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing.
Well, yes, because it does discuss my Latino roots and how much we have in common with other people. We all do, you know.
What year is that poem from?
It was in my 2003 book, Shadows and Supposes.
That work could be just as relevant as if it was written today.
Yes, that's true. It never changes, does it? Well, I grew up with my grandmother. My first language was Spanish, so she was very important in my formation, my personality, everything.
So tell me more about your individual books of poetry.
The first one was Promesas.
Promesas, Geography of the Impossible.
Yes, that was the first one. And well, before that, actually, I had a chapbook. And then I did Woven Voices with my daughter and my mother. And the subtitle to that is, it is interesting. Three generations of Puerto Rican poets look at their American lives. And it's my mother, myself, and my daughter. My mother was a poet. My father was a poet. So the apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
So poetry was just a part of you from the get-go, it sounds like.
Oh, well, it's a highly respected form in among the Puerto Rican culture. There's Carnegie Hall and Carnegie Recital Hall and different places where they would have events, and they would have musicians and dancers, and men would come out and recite, usually men would come out and recite poems, and the whole audience would recite with them because they all knew these poems.
Oh, wow.
And it was like the highlight of the evening, and everybody would stand and applaud. And yes, and I thought, my God, they did respect the word, and it was good. In Puerto Rico, they had jibaros who came from the mountains and would make up poems on the spot.
Oh.
You'd give them a topic, and they would write a poem for you. They would recite a poem for you, and some of them were magnificent. It was a tradition, a really highly respected tradition.
Sounds
beautiful. And now
I'm
working on another collection and a memoir, actually.
Wow. So you are staying quite busy.
Which you've helped me with, because now I've reviewed lots of stuff. And I really loved going back and looking over the books and the magazines and saying, oh, wow, wasn't she wonderful? Wasn't this artist wonderful? Wasn't this musician wonderful? I wish I could listen to all the records. Unfortunately, they're a little obsolete. I might get have them converted into a CD.
I did get to see one of those pull-out records, and I'll be honest, I wouldn't even know what to do with it.
Oh, it was a 45, and we don't have those any longer. But I think I'm going to do that. I think I will get the records and make them into a CD.
That would be a wonderful project.
Wouldn't that be nice?
See, here we go again. You're seeing a need, and you're thinking about how to get it done.
Exactly. Isn't that what it's about? Look
exactly.
What are you doing?
Well, Gloria, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to share your experiences and your stories with us, and as well as your poetry. It's been a great honor and privilege, and I want to just say thank you for seeing a need for something and just going after it tenaciously and creatively. Your legacy here in Kansas City is here to stay, I think. And I'm sure others would agree.
So because it's up to everybody else, you know, at this point. We're all in it together, as they say. But Rochelle, thank you so much for asking me.
Did you enjoy today's slice? You can subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or Stitcher, or like Casey Arpaj on Facebook and follow it on Twitter. Just search for Casey Arpaj. You can also support this podcast by visiting patreon.com/Casey Arpaj. For the price of a cup of coffee or a slice of pie, you can help Casey Arpaj serve up tasty episodes into the future. Until we nosh again, I'm Rochelle Gardner-Rowe, and thank you for listening.